accession number 18751, Real One.
This is a recording of an interview with Mr. S.J. Beecham in Wootton Bassett on Tuesday, the 9th of March, 1999, made by Rodney Giesler for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
Okay, let's see. John, when were you born?
1930. Yes.
And where, around here? Or?
No. I was born at a place called Wokingham in Berkshire, and I stayed there until I left to join the Royal Air Force in 1947.
And were you called up, or did you volunteer?
No, volunteered. Uh-huh. Volunteered.
Why did you want to join the RAF?
Basically, my home life was in tatters. Mm. I'd just come through World War II. As a youngster, as a schoolboy, really, and having left school at 13 and a half, it was still wartime. And I went down to the local fire section and I said, I understand you want volunteers. And they said, we do. How old are you? And I said, 16 and a half. Put my age on. And he said, start on Monday. And on my 14th birthday, I was fighting a fire at the Royal Berkshire Hospital in Reading from a turntable ladder on my 14th birthday. I then left at the end of the war when the chaps came home. We were sent packing with two medals, the Victory and the Defence Medal. And I worked in the post office as a telegram boy on a bicycle in those days. And I then joined the Royal Air Force in 1947. And I stayed in the Royal Air Force then till 1985. And I served in many theatres. The Far East, Singapore, Malaya, Borneo, Korea. Came home. Went to 16MU at Stafford. Met my wife, as she is now. And she then got posted to Middle Wallop. And I came down to Lynham.
Oh, she was in the West, was she?
She was indeed. Yeah. She was indeed. And I came down to RAF Lynham, and I was then at RAF Lynham for 18 years. I became a Transport Command Specialist. But when I passed my training at RAF St Athens...
And you trained as an airframe?
Airframe mechanic, yeah. Mm. It was one of those things where in those days you only did 12 weeks as an airframe mechanic. And I went to a place called RAF Defford, near Worcester, which was radar experimental in those days. Mm-hmm. And whilst at Defford, went into work normally one morning, and the flight sergeant, he said, don't need to put your ovals on, chaps. He said, are you four? He said, I'll go into Lynham. We said, what for? And he said, don't ask stupid questions, off you go. So we got on a train, and we arrived at Lynham, walked in, and Lynham was a buzz. And we thought, what the devil's going on here? All over the airfield were line upon line upon line of decoders, DC-3s. On the terminal building, as it was in those days, which is altered, of course, since then, there were about four Yorks, Avro Yorks, four engine jobs in line. And we walked in, and the warrant officer up there on the line at the time said, what do you know about DC-3s? Where have you been? So I said, well, we've been at Defford at Worcester, experimental. We've worked on different types of aircraft, including, we had a DC-3 there. So he said, you know all about it? So we said, well, not really. So he said, okay, I'll put you out with somebody. And we had a day's tuition at Lynham on the DC-3. And 3 days later, we didn't even unpack our kit. We went onto a decoder, and I went across to Gatto in Germany. And this was the Berlin airlift. It had been started about 3-4 months.
And when, so this was about autumn 48.
That's right. And we arrived at Gatto, and it was really a complete chaotic, organised jumble. It hadn't levelled out to a strict discipline organisation at that time. And we were handling aircraft, DC-3s mostly. We were handling them approximately every 50 seconds. They were coming in and going off. And my job as an airframe mechanic was to turn it round and make sure the hydraulics were okay, the wheels, tyres, brakes were all right, the airframe was in one piece, and mainly sort of just do a quick chuck and it was off again, back out.
It's like a walkabout that a flight engineer would do.
Exactly so, exactly so. And it was an incredible situation. I had, first time I'd ever been overseas, I'd never been further south than Southsea, Portsmouth. That was about as far as I'd got. I'd never been overseas before. And it was a big experience for an 18-year-old who was, to put it mildly, scared, because you realised what you were signing for, and each aircraft was loaded with something. Maybe two aircraft would come in the same, maybe they would be different, different loads. Food, coal, wood, flour, and in one instance, one aircraft came in, I shouldn't forget it, with loaves of bread in boxes. And these were all unloaded in seconds, and when it really got to the heart of the airlift itself, the lorries and the aircraft were nose to tail all the way down the taxi track. And in some instances, one engine was actually kept running. And they were offloaded so fast they were just taxiing around taking off again. But at the actual height of the airlift itself, Berlin airlift, they were landing and taking off every 50 seconds. And there was no time for crashes. We had two casualties. One Dakota went up onto its nose, and another one burst a tyre on landing. But as far as I was concerned, that was the only casualties that we had in the whole entire operation out there.
So in all this sort of rush,
yeah,
your job was entirely just checking airframes?
It was indeed. Yes, it was.
All the loading and unloading went on while you did your job?
Around us, yeah. We had mostly Germans, civilians, and the offloading was in, as it is now, antiquated old lorries and cart horses and things. Horses and carts, but these were being unloaded while we were doing our walk-arounds, and the air crew would be still there, and as fast as we'd done in, we'd sign the paperwork, and they would accept this, and off they would go again, back to wherever they'd come from. But as you are probably well aware, there were three air bridges eventually set up, one for the French, one for the British, and one for the Americans, and the height levels coming into Berlin on the bridge, you would fly in on the top and fly out, fly in on the bottom because you were heavier and fly out on the top, you were lighter going back.
I always thought there were two corridors coming in and one going out.
Well, it did start that way. Oh, no, it didn't. That's how it finished. Mm-hmm. But it started off with coming in heavy at the bottom and going out on the light on the top. Then it became two bridges in and one out.
Yeah. Now, presumably, with all this rush, the last thing you wanted to see was an aircraft with a snag on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And obviously, they happened.
Yes, they did. One aircraft came in, and the captain got out, and he said, "I've got a problem." And we said, "Oh, gosh." And he said, "The port undercarriage is dragging on retraction." So we said, well, the facilities here are very, very limited. And so he flew back to wherever he'd come from with the ground lock pin still in and the undercarriage locked down. And he went back with that snag. But when he came back the next time that we saw them, it was fixed wherever it had gone back from. But I was out there for 4-5 months. And in all that time, the most horrendous thing I saw whilst I was there were the children. They were pathetic little things. The war had finished in 1945, but here we are in 1948, and they were still starving. And the kiddies, of course, we were still on rations, and our sweet rations that we used to get from the NAFI or from wherever, we donated to these kiddies.
Were those the children who were flown out on the airlift, or the children you just saw around?
Children you just saw around. I mean, all around you at Gatto, and I went down to Tempelhof, to Berlin itself. In Berlin itself was absolute devastation. The only thing you could recognise was the Brandenburg Gate. The rest was in brick rubble, the same as London was during the Blitz. And these kiddies and the population were starving, literally starving. And mainly old, very old men, what few there were, very old women, and youngsters, kiddies to about eight. That's all we saw. And
this was 3 years after the end of the war?
3 years after the end of the war. And because they had recruited all the young boys into the army and this sort of thing. And it was a horrendous experience for us. I mean, all right, we'd been deprived during the war, but not as much as they had. And it really opened us up to the German population when we saw them in that state. But very, very good-natured. Language difficulties, of course, occurred, but picture drawings and sign language proved successful, you know.
Where was your billet, actually, on the airfield?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
So you didn't have to commute through the...
No. Now, we were contained at Tempelhof. We were only down there for a week, and then we went back to Gatto, and Gatto was more or less organised. They had buildings... and they had tents and one thing and another, you know, so we were reasonably well off.
Did the RAF come into Tempelhof as well then? Or
yes, he did.
They did, because
yes,
it was mainly an American.
Yes, it was, yeah. But, yes, we did. I used to have a chap down here in where I live now, here. Unfortunately, he died last year, but he was on the airlift with me, and we used to see one another regularly here through the town, yeah.
Now, you were there in Gatto for 4 months.
Yes.
And you worked all hours, did you?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did, yeah.
Well, presumably shifts, because it went around the clock, didn't
that's
it?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yes, we were on 24 hours. Yeah. But, of course, we used to work mainly the hours that we were required to work. Basically, it came down to shift work in the end. But when it started, first of all, we were working dawn till dusk because we had no runway lights. And then we got the old goose flares, the oil burners with the wicks, and then we could operate then into the dusk and into the evening. But the weather was atrocious. Rain. Never seen rain like it all through those 4 months. And the airfield, if you went off the taxi track, off the hard standing, it was like a quagmire. It really was. It was unbelievable. And our biggest dread was an aircraft going to slip off the taxi track onto the mud, onto the grass. But it never happened.
What other snags did you have to look at, apart from this undercarriage?
The undercarriage problem was the biggest one. The only other snag we had was to try and keep the aircraft clean as much as we possibly could, because it would come in with coal. Next time it would come in with flour or rice or something like this. The rice actually came in sacks, which wasn't too bad. But the first Hastings I ever saw come through was actually brand spanking new from Hanley Pages and was full of coal. And it wasn't in bags. It was loose. And there was, well, you can imagine, coal dust everywhere in a brand spanking new aeroplane. And it arrived and it was full of coal. Needless to say, it was soon unloaded, but there was coal dust everywhere you went in that aeroplane. And that was the first one I saw, Mark 1 Hastings, yeah.
Now, you had a huge variety of aeroplanes, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
Coming in, not only RAF, but airlines and...
Oh, yes.
Civil charter companies.
Yes, we did, all sorts. But they were basically transports. We had DC-3s. We had what we know as Skymasters, Avro Yorks. We even had, well, we had Sunderland's landing on the lake, but we even had, I'm trying to think, Lancastrians coming through, which in fact was a civilian version of a Lancaster. And they were carrying any aeroplane that flew that was transport or transport orientated. Had stuff on it for these starving people in Germany.
So you presumably had to spread your talents not only on DC-3s but everything that flew and came in.
Yeah, as I said earlier on, it was very nerve-wracking for me, a young chap, very very nervous, very had to be very careful in case you put a foot wrong and you didn't want to. First experience of real flying and real operational sorties for me. And many others like me, and it was an experience we will never forget, and I trust we never see it again. Although I have since, whilst I was in the Transport Command Fleet. But
when you had time off, presumably you just slept, did you?
I mean, we did. Yeah. Yes, yeah, we had no time for visiting or going off the airfield or anything like this, because if they suddenly had an influx. They needed everybody, sort of on emergency standby, and they'd just come around, wake you. You'd get down there and do it, and that would be it until it quietened down, and then they came around, organised us into parties, and stood us down in shifts, and then until the next rush. But we still maintained our static shift pattern. Yeah.
Presumably, the discipline. Was fairly lax in the sort of official kind of discipline, but I mean, you had your own form
yes,
of discipline.
Yeah, we had a technical discipline, but when it came to dress code or discipline, that went by the book. We were in Wellingtons and sea boots, socks, and old black oilskin macs and things like this, and we even had sou'westers because of the weather, it was reasonably comfortable. Yeah, reasonably comfortable. And the old sort of MT leather jackets, they were also in fashion, you know. Woolly pullies were not heard of in those days. But some of us, we carried our own civilian woolly pullies, which we used to wear, and nobody used to sort of bother.
You didn't bother saluting anyone?
Yes.
That still held?
Saluting an officer, a commissioned officer, still held. Although a lot of them used to say, it's all right, we know, and that was it.
Yeah.
Very good, though. But we used to get on well with all the air crew. A lot of senior NCO air crews in those days, of course. You were very fortunate if you saw a commissioned pilot, for instance, you know. But
So a DC-3 would have, two pilots on it, or...?
Yes. Yeah, two pilots and an engineer.
An engineer.
But... Yes, usually a crew of three up front. And the engineer was responsible for shutting the loading doors and things like this, which is now they've got air load masters for this. But he was responsible for the aircraft to close up for takeoff. Yep.
Did you have much contact with Germans who spoke a bit of English around the place?
We didn't see many.
No.
We didn't see many Germans that spoke English. As I said, sign language was a great thing. And drawings. You could draw on a piece of paper or draw in the dust on the floor or whatever to get over what you wanted or what you needed. Very, very sort of pidgin English they spoke. And, of course, we didn't speak German, or the majority of us didn't, unless you went to an extraordinary school beforehand, you know. But we got by. We got by.
So after 4 months,
yes.
you were pulled out, because the airlift went on for a lot longer, didn't it?
Just over a year.
Yeah.
Just over a year.
You joined it 3 months into it.
Yes.
And left 4 months, so had about another 6 months.
Seven months to go, yeah. Yeah, I was withdrawn because I was brought back to the UK to go back to St Athens to become a fitter 2A. And the courses in those days, you had to fill the place, you had to fill the slot. That is why I was withdrawn from Germany, because they were looking for me at Lynham for a month, just about, and then realised that I was out in Germany somewhere.
And were you attached to a particular squadron at this time?
Not at that time, no. We were... The ground crew were a pool, and we all got on together, airframes, engines, electricians, radio men. We all worked together, lived together, ate together, and we were just a pool. And when an aircraft came in, you would just leap onto it as a gang. And in the end, when I left after 4 months, it was then becoming that each individual gang would do the first one, miss the second one, and then go on to the third one. So they had a gap between the two. But when whilst I was there, we had no hesitation, and we just did them as they came through, one after the
after
other.
After a while, did you begin to recognise familiar aircraft?
Oh, yes. Numbers, yeah.
Yeah,
you got the numbers.
And particular eccentricities they had.
That's right. And in particular, you got to know the aircrew very, very well. They used to work all the hours that God sent, the aircrew did, as we did. And they used to try and get as many sorties as they could in a day, in daylight hours. But weather was against us for a lot of the period. But the aircraft coming through, you would tell the engineer that he'd got a cut on a tyre, get it changed next time round, you know, whilst he was back at base and this sort of thing. Yeah.
Of course, you were very much, I suppose, line maintenance, weren't you?
Yes, we were. Yes, we were.
Anything big, you just couldn't do.
You couldn't
change
do.
An engine, for instance.
No.
Well, it was your job, but I mean...
No.
Yeah.
We had no jacks and that sort of thing out there. Mm. But you could back at base, you see.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we could jack up a wheel and change a wheel. In fact, we did change a propeller on one DC-3, or the engine lads did. And that was the first time that I ever came into contact, if you like, and worked alongside the electricians and engine lads, and actually, as an airframe mechanic, helped them to change a propeller. Everybody mucked in, and it was a great spirit. It was a real esprit de corps was fantastic. They had it during the war, and we had continued the vein on afterwards, and it was very, very interesting, very interesting.
You were talking about the tremendous esprit de corps.
Yes.
Presumably you had your own little luxury as the occasional supply of beer came in, did it? Or?
Yes, and in those days I used to drink and have the odd can, but the aircrew used to bring us in an odd beer, but Gatto itself was well established, well stocked in the airman's mess and this sort of thing.
And they built up stock before the blockade started?
No, they built it up during.
Yeah.
When it first started, Gatto was a bit sparse, as you can well imagine, but it soon built up to keep our troops happy and fed. And
of course, you had the whole Berlin garrison, didn't you?
Exactly so. Yeah. Exactly so. And of course, the rail was cut off, road was cut off. This is why we were feeding Berlin at the time, and until the very end. But we didn't go short, and when we used to sort of sneak, if you like, the odd ration and give it to the children through the fence. Yeah. And we used to have these, the word soon got around, of course, and the kiddies would come in dozens. But you didn't have much time to sort of go to the fence to see to them. Other people, different trades, they did, because we had some armourers. And, of course, the only armament they had on a DC-3 or an Avro York was a Vary pistol. And, of course, the armourers, that's all they had to look at, you know. But so long as it was in the holster and the Vary cartridges were in the slots, that was it. That was the armourer's job finished.
Did you have many American planes coming in?
We had the...
Well, the
C-47s and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I saw one Stratocruiser arrive, but that was about all. Yeah. I didn't see many more. As I say, the main workhorse was a DC-3, the old Decoder. Mm. And I'd never seen so many airplanes in my life. very awe-inspiring for me and very levelling. I'd never been overseas, as I said, and I'd never ever seen this amount of aircraft in one heap, in one lot. And it was continuous, absolutely continuous, all the time.
What was the most unusual cargo that you saw unloaded?
Unusual cargo. I think it was a steel girder which was coming in for Berlin for a powerhouse. Something to do with their power. And of course, they hadn't got steel. And this was actually flown in. And the job we had to get this thing out of an aeroplane was absolutely colossal. It was manhandled, this steel girder. It was a huge thing for the size of the aircraft. And it was mainly, well, you had to manhandle it because there were no rollers in those days. And there were no, like they've got these days with rollers in the aircraft and roller pallets and this sort of thing. There was none of that.
There was a side door as well.
It was a side door, which didn't help. Mm. And, of course, you had to negotiate it over the top of the tailplane or underneath the tail. If I remember rightly, it went underneath the tail. But it was the full length of the fuselage. Apparently had trouble getting it in. And we had even more trouble getting it out because we had no lifting tackle. We had a crane, but it was no good because of its length, you see. It would be tip-heavy, and we had to sort of manhandle the whole thing. But that was the most unusual one, I think, I saw, was this steel girder going down to Berlin to the powerhouse.
And can you recall any more unusual moments? Or
not...
Ironic moments, strange moments?
Not really. When I left... It was a sense of relief that we'd actually finished. And what you didn't realise was just how tired you were. I mean, I was only a young lad, 18, with all the energy in the world. But it wasn't until I came back to Lynham on a DC-3 and I fell asleep leaving Gatow on takeoff. And they had to wake me here at Lynham when we'd already landed and taxied in and stopped. And they came along and said, are you going to get off, you know? And that was when I'd slept the whole journey back from Germany. I didn't even know it. But, yeah, I then went back to my old station at Defford at Worcester. And then within 3-4 days, I was on my way back to St Athens to do a Fitter 2 course, Fitter 2A course.
And what, this was training on different types of aeroplane again, was it? Or at a more advanced skill level?
Advanced skill level, this was. And I then went to 32MU, which is at St Athens, because that's where I did my course on one side of the camp and went over the other. And we were repairing Meteors, which had belly landed at 32MU. And then I went from there to... I was shipped out to Malaya at the height of the communist conflict in 1949. And... I got out to Singapore, and I went an unusual way, if you like. I went out on a carrier, aircraft carrier, HMS Ocean, from King George V Dock at Glasgow. I went out to the harbour, Singapore Harbour, the naval base, offloaded, and went to 390MU at Salita. And at Salita, we did every conceivable aircraft they'd got out there in those days, Spitfire 18s, Spitfire 21s, Tempest Mark 2s, Brigands, Buckmasters, Bowfighters. 390MU was a pool of manpower for the Far East. And we used to get...
This was about 49, was it?
It was 49 now. Yeah, yeah, 49 when I went out there, yeah. And then I went in one day and they said, you've got to go down to 205 Squadron, which was Sunderland's. And then from Sunderland's, we were shipped to Hong Kong, from Hong Kong to Iwakuni in Japan. And I was offloaded at Iwakuni. I built, or helped to build, four Osters. And I finished up at Pusan in South Korea.
And that's when the Korean War started.
The Korean War was on then, yeah.